Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
Welcome to Savage Nation. This is John Ziegler filling in for Michael Savage. Don't worry, you will get your Michael Savage fix just a little bit later on in the program. But for those of you who are saying, John Ziegler, that name sounds vaguely familiar. It's quite possible that you have seen me recently talking about my brand new documentary film, which is called Media Malpractice, How Obama Got Elected and Palin Was Targeted. So in case you're curious, that's who I am. Lots to talk about today on the program. I want to get started with the big news of the day, at least if you care about things like terrorism and whether or not Americans are being taken hostage by terrorists. Of course, you're probably familiar with what is being referred to as the pirate situation off the coast of Kenya. The Associated Press reporting the American captain held hostage by four Somalia pirates made a desperate escape attempt today but was recaptured after they fired shots. An official said other pirates sought to reinforce their colleagues by sailing hijacked ships with other captives aboard to the scene of the standoff. A Somalia in contact with the pirate leader said that the captors want a ransom. That's right, they want a ransom and are ready to kill the hostage, Captain Richard Phillips, if they are attacked. So they are demanding ransom, and we are supposed to negotiate with terrorists, although they're being referred to as pirates. The United States was bolstering its force, although that's a bit of a misnomer, by dispatching other warships to the site off the Horn of Africa, where a U.S. destroyer shadowed the drifting lifeboat, which is carrying Phillips, who they are threatening to kill if they don't get their ransom. He was taken hostage in the pirates' failed attempt to hijack a cargo ship on Wednesday. Now, there's an awful lot to talk about here that isn't being mentioned in the mainstream news media. First of all, this notion of the term pirates being used. This really bugs me on a number of levels. I think it's symbolic of how Hollywood has made such an incredible impact on feminizing our culture. The term pirate used to be about as derogatory a term as you could possibly use to describe somebody. In some circles, it would have been considered worse than terrorist. But now, I believe that we're living in a culture where pirates, largely because of Walt Disney and Pirates of the Caribbean, because of Pirates of the Caribbean, we think of, at worst, there we go, at worst we think of pirates in a romanticized version of the term. That's at worst. But I think in many circles now, here in America, in our culture, we think of pirates as almost being a positive term. If you're a pirate, somehow, you know, you're against the man, you're against authority, and you're romantically sailing the seas as a person who's pursuing their own freedom or whatever. Well, that's ridiculous. And to use the term pirate, which is now almost a term of endearment, to describe people who are clearly terrorists. Now, whether or not they're connected to Al-Qaeda or some other organized group, we don't know yet. It's certainly possible considering that region of the world where Al-Qaeda has made great inroads over the last couple of decades and where we've seen Al-Qaeda-led attacks against Americans before. So that is certainly possible. But regardless of whether they're part of that organization or any other, to call them pirates is an absolute bastardization of the English language. They are terrorists. Now, I realize that we're not allowed to talk about terrorism anymore in the age of Obama. You know, terrorism is actually man-made disaster in this administration. But let's call it what it is. And let's call these people who they are. They are terrorists who are demanding ransom of the United States. Otherwise, they're going to kill Captain Richard Phillips, an American citizen. Now, It's amazing to me that this concept is even being given any credibility whatsoever, but of course it is. I was just surfing the web a few moments ago, and on AOL right now, they're doing a poll. A poll, that's right, of whoever is on AOL right now. Should the American government pay these pirates, actually terrorists, ransom for the safety of Captain Richard Phillips? Now, thankfully, 80% say no. They didn't have a section for hell no, but that should have been one of the answers that would have been provided. But that's beyond ridiculous. The fact that we're even considering this is absurd. You do not negotiate with terrorists, even if they're called pirates. Now, this notion of the whole pirate terminology having an impact here, you might think, well, John, you know, what difference does it really make whether we call them terrorists or pirates? It makes a difference. And I think this was proven yesterday when Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, or Hillary Rodham Clinton, or whatever she's calling herself these days, made an absolutely astonishing statement. Now, first of all, it's absolutely amazing that she's the point person on this, because the last time the American people cared two licks about Somalia, of course, as I referenced earlier, was with regard to the so-called Black Hawk Down disaster in Mogadishu, which occurred, of course, under her husband's watch. And it was, according to many terrorism experts, our running away in that circumstance that eventually led in many ways to numerous other attacks against the United States, including 9/11. So here we have this upside down Alice in Wonderland world where it's Hillary Clinton who is the point person on an issue involving, at least tangentially, Somalia and terrorism directly. And here she was yesterday describing the situation and what the United States' response ought to be.
The world must come together to end the scourge of piracy. You know, I think Morocco was the very first country that recognized us going back a long time. And we worked together to end piracy off of the coast of Morocco all those years ago. And we're going to work together to end this kind of criminal activity anywhere on the high seas.
Now, that's not the proof of what I'm talking about, that words matter. Terminology makes a difference. And when people consider the term pirate to be kind of funny in the 21st century, here we have the Secretary of State of the United States of America, where American citizens' lives are in grave jeopardy, laughing about what is essentially a terrorist attack against the United States. She's laughing about it. Now, that might say an awful lot about her and her capability of holding the position, but I think it also says an awful lot about this term pirates and the impact that it has on how people view the story. Because even the point person, the person that Barack Obama has handed this off to because he wants nothing to do with it, the person who is supposed to be handling the situation thinks it's a laughing matter. And if that doesn't tell you everything you need to know about where we are in this country right now with regard not only to this specific episode, but terrorism in general, I don't know what does. And Michael Savage has already written about this at michaelsavage.com. And by the way, the phone number, if you want to be part of the program, 1-800-449-8255. That's 1-800-449-8255. And, of course, the website, michaelsavage.com. If you go to michaelsavage.com, Michael talks about how the mighty have fallen. And he writes, there are many questions which this incident raises. First of all, why was the crew on board this vessel not armed so they could prevent this sort of hijacking? I heard, this is Michael writing, I heard a reporter say that the ships were given water cannons to defend themselves from pirates. That's wonderful. Maybe our merchant fleet and the U.S. Navy can start arming themselves with water cannons and water balloons in order to gently discourage our enemies from attacking us. And on top of that, some idiot ship owner whose boat was taken over last year got on Fox News and said these crews shouldn't be armed. With idiots like this in positions of power, it's no wonder that these pirates sense weakness and prey on our vessels. And of course, that's really the issue here. It is about the issue of weakness. And I don't think it's a coincidence that we see North Korea firing test missiles, and we see a situation here with regard to terrorists, not pirates, but terrorists testing the resolve of the American government, demanding ransom, seeing how far they can push either Hillary Clinton and or Barack Obama. This is exactly what the type of thing that Joe Biden, of all people, predicted during the campaign when he said, mark my words, there will be an international incident in the first 6 months of the Obama presidency to test this guy. And oh, by the way, remember what he implied? He said, of course, you might not remember this because it wasn't reported at all and certainly not properly. He said, you're going to have to stick with us because it's possible, in fact, probable, that we're not going to handle the situation all that well. At least at first is what he said, that we might be perceived as blowing this one. So you got to stick with us. Well, so far, we've seen absolutely nothing but weakness in response by Hillary Clinton, literally laughing. No words at all from Barack Obama. And this is, well, it's right now a minor episode, an incident. Hopefully it'll stay that way. Hopefully there will not be any fatalities. This is symbolic of the overall philosophy of Barack Obama and clearly his administration when it comes to dealing with a scourge of terrorism. And we saw further evidence of that last week, about a week ago now, where Barack Obama literally bowed to the king of Saudi Arabia and his press person blatantly lied about that. When we come back, I'm going to talk a little bit more about what we know about Barack Obama's view on the issue of terrorism, how he views it, and we'll hear Robert Gibbs flat out lying about Obama's bowing to the king of Saudi Arabia. The phone number 1-800-449-8255. This is John Ziegler sitting in for Michael Savage on The Savage Nation. Savage. My name is John Ziegler, sitting in for Michael Savage on The Savage Nation. We will be hearing from Michael Savage himself later on in the program, but right now I'm honored to be sitting in for the great Michael Savage. Of course, the phone number 1-800-449-8255 and the website michaelsavage.com. I want to just say a couple of things in general about what we know about Barack Obama and, I presume, his administration when it comes to this overall issue of terrorism and this remarkable, very dangerous blind spot that he personally clearly has. The evidence is overwhelming, and obviously we don't know exactly what's going to end up happening with this so-called pirate, actually terrorist situation that's going on off the coast of Kenya. And hopefully it's going to be able to sort its way out and Captain Richard Phillips will be able to be returned home safely. Right now, of course, they are threatening to kill him if we don't pay ransom. And it will be very interesting to see how Hillary Clinton, who's literally laughing about the situation yesterday, and Barack Obama, who has not said one word about it yet, will handle it. Now, what do we know? What we know is that Barack Obama clearly lives in a very pre-9/11 world. I mean very 9/11. And in that film, I show a clip of Barack Obama claiming that our response to the first World Trade Center attack during Bill Clinton's administration, the very beginning of his administration, 1993, I show that Bill Clinton's administration, obviously that was when that first happened, that he said that Bill Clinton's response, Obama did, Bill Clinton's response was perfectly fine and that we had apprehended all the suspects in the 93 bombing and that they had all been brought to justice. He said this on national television, Barack Obama did, during the campaign. Well, that's a flat-out lie. It is flat-out false. The reality is that at least three of the suspects in the 93 World Trade Center bombing were never brought to justice until after 9/11 occurred. One of them died a free man. Another one was last seen in, get this, Iraq. And a third was named Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the uncle of the mastermind of the 93 attacks. And he confessed to it in, of all places, Guantanamo, which, of course, Obama is in the process of closing. And we all saw him on 60 Minutes a couple of weeks ago, where I thought his ego really got the best of him. And this is going to be the seeds, I believe, eventually, whether the media reports it or not, of Barack Obama's demise. His ego is going to get the best of him. And he took on Dick Cheney, who is dead right on this issue, all because he could not acknowledge that he is flat out wrong. And he doesn't know what he's talking about. He's in over his head. course, we're told by the news media that he's all-knowing and he's so smart. The reality is, at least on this issue, he has no idea, no clue. He doesn't know the basic facts, as I just illustrated, on the 93 World Trade Center bombing. If you can't understand the 93 bombing, and you can't, then you certainly can't understand 9/11. If you can't understand 9/11, then you just have no business being commander-in-chief of the United States Armed Forces in a post-9/11 world, which we are still in. I realize people are much more concerned about the economy right now, and understandably so. And by the way, Obama said some very interesting things about the economy, which we're going to get into later on in this hour. But this is not an issue that's simply going away because we have more pressing problems. It is every bit as important as it was on September 12th of 2001, whether Obama and his cronies choose to acknowledge that or not. The phone number 1-800-49-8255. That's 1-800-449-8255. Let's go to the phones. And to Case in Virginia, you're on the Savage Nation with John Ziegler.
Hey, Jim. Thanks for taking my call. The question I have is I just don't understand why we haven't responded. You know, in the previous administration that we had, these guys would never even dream of doing something like this. And then for our credit, current president to be silent about it and for the Secretary of State to laugh about it, I think we have embarked on a new age over here where terrorism is going to become rampant.
Case, you don't think this is coincidental? This is just simply happening by coincidence with a change of administration?
Oh, no, it's not a coincidence. They're testing. They're testing. They're probing. It's not a coincidence. These guys are probing.
Thanks for the call, Case. No, I agree with that. They are testing. We'll see how it all transpires. But it's certainly understandable that they would test. I mean, we've already seen some remarkable missteps in this realm by Barack Obama. You know, there's now this controversy that's been simmering. Of course, the news media, the mainstream news media, of course, not touching it except to dismiss it. This notion that Barack Obama bowed to the king of Saudi Arabia. Well, when we come back on Savage Nation, you're going to hear the White House spokesperson, Robert Gibbs, flat out lie about what Barack Obama did when it came to bowing to the king of Saudi Arabia. My name is John Ziegler, sitting in for Michael Savage on The Savage Nation.
Must come together to end the scourge of piracy. You know, I think Morocco was the very first country that recognized us going back a long time, and we worked together to end piracy off of the coast of Morocco all those years ago, and we're going to work together to end this kind of criminal activity anywhere on the high seas.
Wow, this is John Ziegler sitting in for Michael Savage on the Savage Nation, and that is Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. By the way, it's still difficult for me to say those words in conjunction with one another. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. It's actually more difficult than President Barack Hussein Obama, but it's a close call. There she was yesterday, literally laughing about an incredibly serious situation that's gotten even more serious today with pirates, actually terrorists, why we're obsessed with this pirate term, I don't know, who are demanding ransom for Captain Richard Phillips, threatening to kill him if we don't pay up. And here she was yesterday laughing about this very matter. The phone number here on the Savage Nation, 1-800-449-8255. Chris in New York, you're on the Savage Nation with John Ziegler.
John, it's a pleasure to have you subbing for Michael. Listen, what really scares me about Hillary Clinton's statement wasn't just her laugh, but the fact that she seems to be making fun of the whole history of how we got to this point, because the tradition of Islamic piracy is, unfortunately, it's very old. Today, the problem is in the Indian Ocean. 200 years ago, it was in the Mediterranean. Now, before our revolution, we were protected by the Royal Navy, but then when we declared independence, of course, the British were no longer protecting us. So Americans were being taken hostage then. And what was our response then? Jefferson knew what to do. He fought. He sent the Marines there. That's where the second line of the Marine Corps him comes from the shores of Tripoli. If we don't figure out if we don't remember our own history and what the larger perspective of this historical situation is, we're going to be facing another 9/11. The second thing that scares me about her statement was she said that this is a criminal matter. She's right. not realizing that this is in a larger context. The same right. thing happened after from this absurd statement from Obama, saying that Clinton, you know, that he solved the problem after the first bombing of the
World Trade Center. Absolutely.
Attacks that took place in the 1990s under his
right.
administration.
And numerous. And they were just, and thanks for the call, Chris. But why would you expect the Secretary of State of the United States of America to actually know the basic history? Or the President of the United States, for that matter, as I articulated, and doesn't know the basic facts. I guess that's asking too much for them to know the basic facts of the history that led up to the situation that we're in. Now, hopefully this is still going to be an asterisk on the Obama administration. Everyone's going to be okay. I'm still hopeful that that will end up being the case. But what we're seeing here is a very quickly growing pattern. And we're not learning from our history, not just the history that Chris, the caller from New York, mentioned, but obviously even more recent history. And by the way, Michael Savage writes in his column How the Mighty Have Fallen a lot about what Chris just mentioned at michaelsavage.com. So I urge you to check that out, How the Mighty Have Fallen, with regard to the U.S. Navy and the history that is involved here. But we're talking about very basic history and remarkably dangerous ignorance that could lead to much, much larger problems. Now, a lot of people have been having fun with an issue that I'm not sure it's necessarily all that important in its in a micro context. In a larger context, it might be. But I'm referring to this episode that occurred about a week ago, where Barack Obama appears to be bowing to the king of Saudi Arabia, King Abdullah. Now, if you watch the video, it's very odd, because it's like a half bow. It's almost like he started the bow and then realized, what the hell am I doing here? But it's clearly a bow, or it's clearly an intended bow. Far more of a bow, by the way, that he gave the Queen of England. Now, what's really amazing is it took several days for any legitimate questions to be asked about this by the mainstream news media. Yesterday, it finally happened where a reporter asked Robert Gibbs, who's the White House spokesperson, the paid liar on behalf of the Obama administration, whether or not this, in fact, was a bow. And listen to this rather bizarre exchange.
We took a look at the video, and it does appear that the president actually bowed to King Abdullah. Did he bow or didn't he?
No, I think he bent over with both to shake with both hands to shake his hand. So I don't
just show one hand that he used.
No,
this is power, didn't he?
No, but I think this meeting was like a week ago, right?
That's right. But this is something that a lot of people are still talking about today.
I can only imagine it is of great cause and concern for many people struggling with the economy.
Wow. All right. Now, that's the White House spokesperson, Robert Gibbs. And let's go through this, because it's rather humorous, although somewhat important as well. The first line of attack is, no, he didn't actually bow to the king of Saudi Arabia. Now, we know that that's a lie. We know it's a lie. If you look at the video, he clearly bowed. It was not a handshake where you just kind of dip down a couple of inches. No, not even close to that. It's very obvious from the video. But what's really interesting to me is that Gibbs has a backup plan. If, in fact, I'm wrong about my lie, which clearly he is, that this was not really a bow, then the second line of defense is, didn't this happen a week ago? So why are we talking about this? You didn't ask me about it immediately, so I'm going to play news director and determine that this is now a stale news story and not worthy of discussion. So that's line of defense number two. But if you decide that I'm lying and that this story that the President of the United States bowing to the King of Saudi Arabia has more of a shelf life than, say, a week, then the third line of defense, which is, you know, pretty much like one of the last bastions of scoundrels, which is, well, we shouldn't even be talking about this because the economy sucks. Now, that's pretty much when you know a spokesperson is lying. It's essentially the same thing as a lawyer does. What, you know, when you don't have the law, you know, you pound on the facts. If you don't have the pound, if you don't have the facts, you pound on the table. That's basically what's going on here. And in this case, they're saying, well, you know what, we're going to throw out the lie. If you don't go for the lie, then it's too old. And if you don't go for it being too old, then we're going to say, well, you know what, we shouldn't even be talking about this because people are suffering. And when people are suffering, we can't be criticizing the President of the United States. Oh, really? It's interesting how quickly the rules change in just a couple of months. Can you imagine? And by the way, this is going to be the standard that will be used for the length of the Obama administration, which unfortunately I believe is going to be 8 years, thanks to the news media completely and totally being in the tank for him. The standard is going to be, what would have happened had George W. Bush done the same thing? Now, clearly, George W. Bush made a lot of mistakes in his administration. But the reality is, if George W. Bush, and I thought it was as nauseating as anybody did when we saw those photographs of Bush holding hands with the Saudi King Abdullah. Frankly, as much criticism he got, as he got rightfully so for holding hands with King Abdullah, Barack Obama has gotten nothing in comparison from the mainstream news media from actually bowing to the king, which I personally think is far worse than even the holding of the hands. But this is par for the course when it comes to the news media and the Messiah, Barack Obama. We're, of course, told that he is so worldly and so smart and so educated and so eloquent and so charismatic that he couldn't possibly be making such elementary mistakes. And therefore, either they're being misinterpreted or we're going to pretend they didn't really happen. Whatever it is, move on, people. This is not that important. But again, my perspective on this is it is part of a much larger, much more important picture. And that is that Barack Obama clearly doesn't get it when it comes to the issue of Islamic radicalism in general, terrorism in particular. He is naive and he is arrogant. And that's a deadly, almost, it could be, unfortunately, a literally deadly combination when you are that naive and you are that arrogant and you believe in appeasement. And when we live in a world where the only thing these people are going to respect is strength, we are never going to be liked. Forget about being liked. We are never going to be liked as long as we are still the United States of America. We damn well at least better be respected. And Barack Obama clearly doesn't get that. But we can't be talking about that because, of course, the economy is bad and people are suffering. Now, speaking of the bad economy, even though Barack Obama does not want to be heard at all on the issue regarding the terrorists holding an American hostage, he did speak today about the economy. And guess what, folks? According to Barack Obama, things are improving. He had talked quite at length about, thanks to, I assume, things that he and his administration have done, that we're starting to see glimmers of hope. Now, he doesn't refer to glimmers of hope in this particular soundbite, but I do want you to hear that he feels, which is typical liberal term, he feels good about what's going on specifically with small businesses.
We feel very good about the progress that we're making in unlocking lending in some particular markets, for example, the small business area. Some of you will recall that a couple of weeks ago we made a presentation about how we were going to help fall lending to small businesses. And I'm pleased to discover that because of our actions, we've seen a 20% increase in the largest SBA loans program in the last month alone. And what that means is that small businesses are starting to get money that allows them to keep their doors open, make payroll, and that is going to contribute to overall economic growth as well as help make sure that people are able to keep their jobs.
Wow. Okay. So here we are, early April, and what we've been told time and time and time again is the worst economic crisis since at least the Depression, if not the beginning of man, is already showing some signs of turning around, at least when it comes to small businesses. Of course, if you're a small business that ends up making more than $250,000 a year, hold on to your wallet, look out. And if you are an employee of a small business that makes that kind of money, you may be looking for a job, especially with the unemployment rate as it currently is. But Obama, the Messiah, did say that we are seeing glimmers of hope. Now, you would think that since he ran a campaign entirely on the notion of hope, we'd be seeing a little bit more than just glimmers. But Obama did say we are seeing glimmers of hope, and here's how he described that.
We have also seen this month people starting to get their first checks in terms of the tax cuts that were initiated through the recovery package. And when you combine it with the other efforts that are being made across the country for infrastructure projects, for the kinds of innovative energy programs that were part of the recovery package. What you're starting to see is glimmers of hope across the economy.
Now, that is a fascinating soundbite from the Messiah, Barack Obama, from a number of perspectives. First of all, he's claiming that the economy is somewhat getting better, turning the corner, whatever, glimmers of hope, however you want to phrase it. Now, if that is indeed the case, then I presume he's taking credit, right? Well, if he's taking credit for some sort of progress in the economy, does that not mean that he must take ownership relatively soon of that economy? Or, to follow the logic, if that's not the case, if we really are seeing glimmers of hope, and I don't know enough about it, I don't think anyone knows enough about it to know for sure that we are, if we are, then doesn't that, instead, if he's not going to take ownership of the economy, doesn't that at least imply that either it wasn't as bad as he told us, or that since this is still the Bush economy, that somehow whatever it was that occurred in the Bush administration has now reaped benefits to allow this thing to not be as bad as it could have been, or potentially now, as he says, show us glimmers of hope. Now, it's all rhetoric. It's all a bunch of BS. But let's at least not allow him to have it both ways. If there are glimmers of hope and you're taking credit, then that means you own it, buddy. And at some point, if you own it, you've got to take blame if it doesn't actually return to what the American people expect. Also, I find it amazing, he's taking credit for the positive impact of tax cuts. So you're now acknowledging that tax cuts work? Wow. Thank you so much, Barack Obama. So then why in the world are you going to destroy what's left of our economy by taxing the hell out of people who actually generate jobs in this country? Of course, that question will never get asked of the Messiah. The phone number is 1-800-449-8255. The website, michaelsavage.com. My name is John Ziegler, sitting in for Michael Savage on The Savage Nation. This is John Ziegler sitting in for Michael Savage on The Savage Nation. In the next hour, we will hear from Michael Savage himself. But right now, I am thrilled to continue to fill in for the great Michael Savage, whose website, of course, is michaelsavage.com. The phone number, 1-800-449-8255. And I'm a big believer that if you pay attention long enough, the truth is always, always going to come out. Even in this media environment where we so rarely get the truth, especially when it comes to anything negative about liberals or specifically about Barack Obama. Even in that environment, if you look carefully enough, the truth will happen. It will release itself and you will be free. And because, of course, the truth sets you free. Well, that happened last night on the Rachel Maddow show on MSNBC, which I never watch. But thankfully, we have producers on this program who do, so that you can hear some of the hogwash that happens on these types of programs. And this is what occurred last night. Chuck Schumer, the senior senator from New York, total sleazeball, Chuck Schumer, made a mistake. He spoke the truth. He felt comfortable enough on the left-wing nut job show that is run by Rachel Maddow on MSNBC, which is now just an advocacy network. It's no longer a news network. They decided very early on during the primary season in the 2008 election, they were going to jump on the Barack Obama bandwagon and ride it for all it's worth. I mean, they have no journalistic integrity to begin with. And they were number three in the ratings. And so they knew that from their overnight ratings that every time Barack Obama came on or they did a story on him or they carried one of his speeches, they got a small spike in their ratings. Now, for them, any kind of a spike, three people was significant to MSNBC. But that's what happened. They clearly made a decision at the network level. Let's ride this bandwagon for all it's worth. And it really led to him winning the Democratic nomination and eventually the presidency. Well, last night on MSNBC, Chuck Schumer revealed what the Democratic Party is really all about. As you listen to this, I want you to think about whether or not Chuck Schumer gives a damn about what's best for the country or whether or not he's solely, and I mean solely, concerned about what's in the best political interest of the Democratic Party. Here's Chuck Schumer last night on MSNBC.
The hard right, which still believes when the federal government moves, chop off its hands, still believes, you know, the traditional values kind of arguments and strong foreign policy, all that's over. So they have nothing other than to say no. And the good news for us, I'll make 2 points here. The good news for us is the polls show that the Republican Party in the House and Senate is at the lowest ratings they've had in a long time, while Democrats are pretty high. So there's no strategy clearly isn't working with the public. And I think President Obama has a pretty smart strategy. He's going to talk bipartisanship to the American people, but realizes that until the Republican grassroots pushes their people over, if that ever happens, we're not going to get change in the House and Senate.
Wow. Now, that is a statement that I could probably talk about for hours, but I only have a little over a minute and a half. So here's what I'm going to tell you about that. First of all, traditional values and a strong foreign policy are over. Not from a perspective of being right for the country, but he's talking about it from a political standpoint. Politically, they are over. Not one whit of care about what's good for the nation or what puts us in a more vulnerable position to our people actually being killed or what's actually good for our culture. No, we don't care about that. The good news for Democrats is in the polls. And then he says that Obama has a good strategy to talk bipartisanship to Americans. He's revealing there that it's all a fraud and a farce, that it's nothing but a way for Obama to pretend that he's something he's not in a way that will appeal to people who aren't paying attention. These so-called moderates or independents who believe whatever the news media spoon feeds them, which is why Obama got elected to begin with. This is absolutely astonishing that a guy with this much power is revealing on a television network, allegedly a national television network, allegedly a news network that's now an advocacy network, MSNBC, what they're really all about. They don't give a damn about anything but themselves. Now, that's not news, but it is news when they actually say it. I realize politics influences everything, but it shouldn't be all that matters. Michael Savage is coming up next. My name is John Ziegler. It's been a pleasure sitting in for Michael Savage right here on The Savage Nation.
Savage.
Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage. Listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
Let's go to the call. Also the saxophone piece. Let me hear the saxophone piece so that we'll get him up to speed. My favorite saxophone piece in the world. That you can find, right? That you can pick up. I see. There's a short lead up. Not the whole thing. It's 10 seconds. God, this guy was I can remember when I first heard this. Me out of my ethnic background. It was so good. The saxophone was so good it broke my genealogical chain. Oh, I fell in love with jazz because of this music. I got news for you. My father was not a religious man. He was a total atheist. Didn't believe in God. I got to tell you right now. I mean, my mother was a God-believing woman. She's the one who gave me the spark. My father was not. He was from Russia. He wasn't a communist, but he didn't believe in anything, truthfully. He was cynic about politics, cynic about religion. He wasn't one or the other. He was just a practical guy. He did read five newspapers every night. I said, what are you reading five papers for? He said, I get all opinions from this paper, the Post, is liberal. That paper, the Journal was conservative, was right-wing. I don't know. He read them all. Then he decided what he wanted to believe was true. See, that's how you should be. That's how you should be, open-minded instead of a closed-minded left-wing nut, as most of you are. But the point I'm making is the music. So I listened to the jazz music, and I started bringing home Nat Cannonball Adderley, remember? And I'd play it in the house, then he'd come home. What are you listening to that junky music for? Turn it off. What junky music? I like the music. Turn it off. No junky music in my house. He didn't want to hear it. Then eventually he started to like it. That's what happened. I'd catch him listening to like Ray Charles in the car. I think that's when he told me after that you can't have music in the car because I'm liable to hear what he liked, which was the same music I liked. You know, fathers and sons have their shtick. Ah, I miss them all, holiday time. You know, holiday time is another story. But I told you that we were very, very, very strong-willed people, like mountain, European mountain people who like learned stoicism over 700 years of deprivation, learned to live on next to nothing. Just eat like, I don't know what they ate, the ancestors in the old country. No wonder they wanted, but they lived long and they didn't want to live long, but they did. Now I want to live long and I can't because of the, you know, it's a paradox. You have everything and you want to live long, but you can't because you're living too high on this food scale. They lived on kasha, which is like a grain, an unseasoned grain. And there's no animal product because if they killed the animal, they lost milk and cheese. So they had no animal product. Maybe once in a while for a holiday. That's why they lived long. They lived grim, horrible lives with mud like a bad Tolstoy, a bad piece of a Dostoevsky novel. A muddy village with a wagon wheel getting caught in the rut. Horrible. I heard in the old country, I swear, I only learned this recently. I never looked into it. They lived in one room with like smoke coming out of the chimney. And the grandparents, they slept up near the fireplace. Like they had an open hearth that covered the entire room in the middle, because that projected warmth. And the grandparents, they rigged up like a bunk bed right next to the fireplace because they would have died from the cold. That's why I have trouble with heat to this day. I myself prefer the cold. But can I admit to you something I did recently? Am I allowed to admit this on the show? I try always to be stoic to this day, but it doesn't work eventually. Somebody bought me a heating thing that goes under the, not a heating pad, a heating sheet that goes under because I don't put heat on at night, okay? I hate the heat. I'm stuffy. I sleep with the window open, you know, the door, and it gets like 39, 40, 30. It's getting very cold here, and it's damp in Northern California. I hate the damp, but on the other hand, I don't like the heat. So I'm sleeping with the window open with no heat. It's a toss-up. I said, why don't you try a heating sheet? So I get a heating sheet. I put it on, I got sissies. I'm not that good. I put it in the bed. I can't believe it. The aches in my bone in my hand went away from one night in the heating thing. And like a head cold cleared up. Would you believe it? There's a lot to be said for modern conveyances. I got to tell you, next I'm going to try central heating in the house. I may move up to some other modern. No, I'm serious. Yakima, Washington. Dan, you're on the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
Yes, that the saxophone you're talking about, that's a tenor sax.
Right, tenor, not alto sax.
No,
tenor.
I play the alto. That's a little higher. It sings more.
When he goes into the countertone, that's a tenor sax going into what?
Into the lower register of its, there's a octave key. He presses that when he wants to be in the higher register. When he wants to go to that low note you're referring to, lets go of that, and he goes down, he closes his pads, and he goes to the key that he's after. And he can go low if he closes to the note he wants.
But Dan, that was a very 50s thing, that counter low note, wasn't it? I don't hear that done anymore. Does anyone do that anymore?
Yeah, it's done if you need that note. You just go to it, and they do it on the end of the tunes.
But this guy, Beowulf, who was he, Tex? What was his name? Jesse Tex Powell. Was he a famous sax player, Dan?
Jerry Mulligan was the great baritone sax player.
Oh, I love Jerry Mulligan. You're bringing back memories now.
Kenny,
we had a Dumont television with a great speaker in it. I used to lie on the living room floor in the few hours I had to myself, and I'd listen to a certain jazz show on Saturday mornings for hours, and I'd listen to that sound coming out of that speaker. It was all Jerry Mulligan. It was a great era for jazz.
baritone sax.
Baritone sax, my God. I always wanted to play that instrument, Dan. I have no facility with music. Would you believe it?
Well, Kenny...
Either people do or they don't. I can't play an instrument.
G plays the soprano.
Who
See,
does?
There's about five saxophones. They're named after Adolf Sax, the Belgian. He was from Belgium. His name was Adolf Sax.
Do you think I could still learn the saxophone at my age, take up something like... Huh? Any age you can learn?
Yes, it's simple.
Which one should I use to start? Which one of them?
I like the alto.
That's the smaller one?
It's the higher of the tenor.
Okay, and then if I do that, then I can move up and get one where I can do a note like that.
You can play all of them. If you can play one, you can play them. They're all fingered the same. It's the size of the horn that makes the difference of the range.
Isn't that something? Well, I appreciate this call, Dan. I'm going to send you a copy of my book, Psychological Nudity, for being so informative. I don't know. People say you should do what you wanted to do when you were young and you didn't get a chance, or you tried it and put it down for whatever things came along. In that light, there's so many things I'd like to try. I mean, but who's going to try it all? Maybe the saxophone could be one of them. That I could try. That I could definitely try. That's a manly instrument, not the flute. Remember, I tried the flute. My father caught me in the basement playing the flute. Did I ever tell you that story? Oh, my God. I went through a phase in college. I got a flute. Because I like Cuban music. And I particularly like the wooden flute that Jose Fajardo played. It was astounding to me. Papacheco, Jose Fajardo. There was the Cuban flute. Nobody was as good as them. They would go off on these reveries in the flute that were astounding to me. I remember going to a nightclub in New York called the Palladium, and I'd stand and listen to the flute players in particular. And once I asked Jose Fajardo, I think actually I was in Miami, God knows, years later, I went up to him. I thought he was God. You know how you look up to a musician, they're just people, you know. So I said, oh, Mr. Fajardo, how do you get your inspiration to come up with these particular improvisations? And he says to me, I don't know, he was pulling my leg. He said, I have a lot of birds, and I listen to the birdies sing. I don't know if he was kidding me or what. He probably was telling me the truth, because I listen to birds sometimes, and I imitate bird sounds. I whistle to them. I'm very good at it. There's another side of me you don't know, a little crazy, I know, to listen to birds. And go, my dog loves it, too. But if I'm out in the woods walking my dog, and I hear a bird singing, I can mimic the sound very closely. The dog looks at me and blah, blah, blah. But anyway, I don't know. Maybe I should take up the saxophone. That might be something to do with my spare time. It might be a nice thing. Anyway, that's one thing. Dizzy Gillespie, Night in Tunisia, one of the great jazz pieces of all time. Recorded between 1946 and 1949. This is a guy who was a pioneer. If you understand what bop education means or bop music, just feel it. Anyway, I'm not a music guy, but it's Cubano pop. Well, stop for a minute. Go back to the opening. Just for a minute. Hold on. Now, imagine if you're a kid from a very ordinary background and never heard real jazz music, and suddenly you hear this clarion call, this coming out of nowhere, out of the nights of New York. One night you're driving late, coming over the 59th Street Bridge, and the Silver Cup Bread Factory is still making bread. Can you imagine? Not movies. And the smoke's coming out of this chimney, 3 a.m, and you hear this. And then there's Symphony Sid playing this with his great cigarette voice. And he's telling you it's Dizzy Gillespie, Night in Tunisia. And that's Dizzy Gillespie on vocals and trumpet, James Moody on the tenor saxophone, Cecil Payne the baritone sax. That's John Lewis on the piano, Milt Jackson on the vibraphone, Ray Brown on the upright bass, and Chano Pazzo on the congas and bongos. I mean, it changes your whole life. Raw moments that move you into another sphere, breaks your genealogical chain, I gotta tell you. Whatever, turn it off. Nobody got them, talking to myself. Oh, Manteca's actually better on this album. You don't have that. Do you have Manteca? No? All right, forget it. I'm already asking for too much. Savage. Right now, I have a rare treat for you, which is Orquesta Aragon with one of their great, great pieces called Padre Cochero. Listen to this. It's not yet. Just give me a few minutes. I do so much for you. Bear with me. I know you want to hear me blast Obama. I'm not going to do it right now. Wait till he gets to this point. Orquesta Aragon de Cuba, blah, blah, blah. Just bear with me. Listen to this. Pare. Hey. 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 Now, when you're trapped doing advanced algebra, physiology, anatomy, whatever you're doing, philosophy, and you can get off on this music, you're a lucky person. What is the point of music? It's supposed to lift you out of the ordinary, isn't it? Like any other art. See, whatever. All right, now I'm talking to myself. I'm going to do politics now. No, Blago didn't talk to Obama. How could you not believe that? What, do you believe in Santa Claus? Of course he talked to him about it. I mean, the guy was the governor of the state. The guy took his seat in Congress. Of course they talked. Of course Rahm Emanuel was involved. What's the mystery here? How do you think American politics works? You want me to lay it on long? I'm going to give you a shocker right now. I'll give you a shocker. It would be a disaster for America if the prosecutor got overzealous and tried to destroy Obama right now. How do you like that? It would be a disaster. It'd be the worst thing this country could experience. Are you people, you see, you don't even understand the ramifications of this. What could benefit the country to bring Obama to his knees right now? Tell me the benefit to such a situation. We're in a depression. They're printing money. They've tripled the national debt. The country is flooded with illegal immigrants and sleeper cells. What would the benefit be to destroy Obama's presidency? They really ought to leave this alone. You want to go high up on the food chain, then go after Rahm Emanuel. And then you better be ready for a chief of staff that's going to be so far to the left that it'll make Rahm Emanuel look like a right winger. You know, you got to watch out where this goes. Got to watch out where this goes. See, this guy Blago, there's no question in my mind he's a psycho. I watched him the other day when he came out and said, I will fight, I will fight, I will fight. This guy's crazy. I mean, it's one thing to have done it. It's another thing to have gotten caught on tape. And then it's a third thing to not listen to your lawyers and get up there and think you're so charming that you can charm the pants off America by saying you're going to fight. And your mother told you to read IF on the air. I mean, they must be listening to my show because I'm the only one in the media who's read IF over the last 10 years. Nobody in the media has read Rudyard Kipling's IF. So there's no question in my mind that the guy loves the show. I mean, I don't blame him, but I think he's a little buggy to have gone out there and get off the stage because this is not good for his state. It's not good for America. But I'm a pragmatist at the end of the day. Do you understand this? Puchero, pare, cuchero. Crack dealers are shielded by San Francisco city officials. I don't know how much it's going to take till you realize that the city of San Francisco is not compassionate, that the city transsexuals or metrosexuals, shall I say, who run this city are not doing it out of compassion. They are doing it to shield crack dealers. They're hiding them from federal immigration officials, even though it's illegal to do so, and they should go to jail. The head of the youth authority should be in prison. The DA should be in prison. Anyone up and down the chain should be in prison who knew this. I don't understand why the federal government does not move on the city. We need federal intervention here. The city's out of control. We have a homicide epidemic. We have a crime wave. And now we have city officials hiding crack dealers in facilities that cost $7,000 a month, paid for by taxpayers. Starbucks closing 600 stores in the U.S. Unbelievable to me. We're actually in a, I don't know, it's like a shadow depression. I would call it, yeah, steal that. Yeah, steal that now. Put it on your blog. Write your article for NRO. Shadow depression, Michael Savage calls it. Steal this phrase like you did compassionate conservative. Steal a phrase like you did so many other things and make believe I don't exist. It doesn't matter to me at a certain point. I'm not resentful at all. I am like Lao Tzu. It doesn't matter who gets credit for my ideas. It doesn't matter at all as long as you listen to the show and you know where they originate. I am like the guy who throws the pebble in the pond.
Listening to an encore segment of the Savage Nation.
Illinois, Mike, go ahead, please. You're on the Savage Nation topic, please.
Yes, I'd just like to comment on the not to take away from the story in court. I was born in New York, grew up in Iowa, moved there in the late 70s with my family. We refer to Iowa City as the United Nations. It's important to point out,
we're talking about the fact that the illegitimate in black robes in the Iowa so-called Supreme Court legitimized homosexual marriage. So what is your main point?
Yes, sir. My point is, the comment was made that the people in the reason this is happening more in the Midwest is that the people are more easily duped. And I'd like to point out that that might not necessarily be the case. For instance, in a state like Iowa, you have two major Big Ten universities, one being in Ames, Iowa State University, the other one being in Iowa City.
Well, what is your point? My headline is gay bulls cow Midwesterners because they're more naive. You're disagreeing with the naive comment.
Okay, no, my point is that the state is being, the general mindset of those black robbers in the Supreme Court is being manipulated by university.
Yes, it's the same everywhere. A group of unelected, radical left-wingers in the legal profession finagle their way into judgeships. Then they wind up on a so-called state Supreme Court. Then they do what they want and what the homosexual mafia and the ACLU want, not what the people want. Isn't that what you're saying?
Absolutely.
All right, good. I almost got a headache. I mean, that's the same story over and over and over again. I told you what happened in ancient China during the Age of the Mandarins. Please give me 30 seconds. So you understand what's going on in this country in a different context. China was ahead of the world by 1,000 years. At about 1000 AD, they had 6-masted sailing ships. Their technology was centuries ahead of the rest of the world. And then what happened is a small group of mandarins, it is estimated they were, I think, 40,000 in number. They were the bureaucrats. They were the government officials. They were the Democrats and Republicans of their time. They grew the long fingernails. When you say mandarins, you think of the Chinese with long fingernails, sitting there stroking their long beards. They controlled every aspect of the average Chinese person's life from cradle to grave. And they started to lay down so many bureaucratic laws and penalties and taxes and red tape that they crushed the developing technology in China. They crushed the developing entrepreneurship of China. They crushed the emerging businesses of ancient China. And China fell into disrepair for over 1,000 years because of a massive Mandarin bureaucracy that arose around the year 1000 or 1100 AD. We have a Mandarin class in America that is exemplified by Obama and is exemplified by the Supreme Courts of our states, exemplified by the mayors of our cities, exemplified by big city police chiefs who can't even fire a gun in most cases, and make the men who do the actual job of constraining the bad people pay for it if they do too good a job. That's what I mean by Mandarins. It went on in China, and it's strangling us today. You get it? And make no mistake about it, Obama is a Mandarin in that regard. He is a Mandarin. Forget racial issues. For God's sake, I don't care about it. I said it during the election. He is not too black. He is too green. This man is a starry-eyed, idealistic dreamer. That's all very well and good. But when you're a president and you have to care for your people more than you have to care for the people of the world, but you have been raised to believe that the whole world is one and all people are equal and all constitutions are the same, and that you want to blend everything together into one giant omelet, we have a very dangerous situation on our hands. Karl Marx said, in order to make an omelet, you've got to break a few eggs. Let us pray that we have a strong enough constitutional government that they will not permit Obama the Mandarin to make an omelet out of this country and roll us into the New World Order omelet.
Savage.
New York City, Elaine, welcome to the program from WOR. I appreciate your calling.
Michael, oh my God, I love you.
You should.
I'm a black woman from Africa.
I'm sorry, you love me and you're a what lady?
I'm a black woman. I'm from Africa.
God bless you.
I absolutely love you, Michael. My family wants to kill me.
Elaine, do you know why you love me? Because I sound like a strong, principled, wise man of the type that exists in Africa in traditional communities. A man who sees clearly and speaks clearly is a rarity in this world, whether it be in Africa or in New York City. And that is why you are drawn to this show.
Oh, that's true, Michael. And you speak the truth. You know, you're not a racist. Whether it's Obama or Bush, they're all the same, Michael. And
Thank you. Thank you for hearing. Thank you for being an educated mind.
Absolutely. And you know what? I believe.
Elaine, which country do you hail from in Africa?
I'm from Cameroon. To Central Africa?
I know where Cameroon is. I know very well some of the most beautiful people on earth come from your country. How long have you been here?
Love your show.
How long have you been in this country, Elaine?
I've been here for 6 years already.
And do you love it?
I love it. You know what, Mike? I absolutely love it. I came to this country, Michael. I did not know any English. I learned English. I went to college.
How come you could learn English, but the Vietnamese man who shot all those people last week couldn't learn English? Why is that?
That's what I was saying. I learned the language in 2 months, Michael. I went to college.
How long?
Think.
Wait, Elaine, how long did it take you to learn English?
2 months, Michael. When I came.
Wait, let's back up for a minute. Did you have any English training in Cameroon?
Just the basic, Michael.
How did you learn it so fast? You must be a super intelligent lady.
Because when I came in, I started working right away. I was working at a sandwich shop and going to college at the same time.
And what did you graduate in? In what field, Elaine?
Marketing.
And are you currently working?
Yes, I'm actually working in the financial industry, yes.
I am so happy to hear this. This is an American success story. You are the hope for America, women like yourself, Elaine. I really mean this. And I would tell you, I'm going to send you a gift of my wonderful book, Psychological Nudity. Stay in the line. I got a word that the shipment has just arrived. All of you who are waiting for the back order on the third printing, it's going to be shipped today. And now we have a fresh new third printing of that book. And I'm very proud to tell you it'll be shipping all week. Psychological Nudity for free to that young lady. I mean, I can go on and on and on. I hate the words racist and racism. It is so tired. It is so boring. It is the standard argument of the people without argument. It is used strictly to try to disarm the enemy, and it is such a weak attempt. Let us use logic together, ladies and gentlemen. We are all one people in a sense and one nation. Just because we have a polarizer does not mean we have to be polarized. And just because we have a divider in the White House, surrounded by dividers who love crises, does not mean we have to fall for the oldest of tricks used by demagogues going back to the kings of Egypt.
Savage.
It is the Savage Nation. Fajardo de Pony Agassar. Just playing some of my music from years ago. Just for a minute. Give me a break. Talk about Bernie Madoff, Obama, and immigrants in a minute. I slashed his wrists. Ugh. All over money, you cut your wrists. Found his wrist slashed. Hear this? Hear this story? Wait, let me just hear this riff, then I'll get back to business. I like to see Madoff's goose cooked. With him in the pot. That rat son of a gun. Smirking at everyone, you son of a gun. What you did to your people, it'll take centuries to overcome the anti-Semitism that you're going to unleash, Madoff. You bum, you piece of garbage. smirking at everyone like you got everyone beat, you piece. Sorry, I just jerked the thing off. You hear what I mean, the bird? That's what Fajardo said to me. He listens to the birds. Maybe he was telling me the truth. Why not? Why not get your inspiration from nature? I've heard birds sound like this. He would climb the scales on that flute. I would want to cry. I feel like jumping up and reaching and jumping onto a cloud. How could anyone do that, I asked myself. I'm stuck eating like a bad meal on a Friday night in a house in Queens. And you get in the car and you drive into the city and you hear this kind of music. You can't believe there's another world like that out there. You know what I mean? Of course, it can mislead you totally, too. There's a lot of people crashed out totally in their lives just following the music and the drugs. I was lucky. I had some controls in me. Centuries, ages of controls built into me. Listen to this. Whatever. I don't go to this music anymore. Maybe I should. They say that Palmieri's coming to town. Some guy, good friend of mine, wants me to go hear him. Hey, Agosar, Michael Savage, Jose Fajardo. So the guy, I linked up a story. It's a tragedy. Hedge fund founder who lost $1.4 billion in Madoff scandal found dead in apparent suicide from Fox News. It's a heck of a story. Tragedy, yes. So here's a high-class French guy, age 65, who lost as much as one, both wrists slashed. They find a box cutter and a bottle of sleeping pills on his desk. No suicide note was found. Villachouet could not cope with the pressure following the outbreak of the scandal. The Tribune's website said, quoting his relatives, "This is a farewell from someone who had done nothing wrong." I agree. He did nothing wrong, but the SOB who... Let me stop right here. I can't say it, what I'd like to say. De La Villachouet's fund enlisted links to Europe's highest society, including Prince Michel of former Yugoslavia and Philippe Junot, a French businessman who was the former husband of Princess Caroline of Monaco. He lived in an affluent suburb of Westchester County with his wife. They have no children. There's no answer at the family's house. So here's a guy who did the right thing, but he couldn't live with the shame. Came from a, I figured, a long line of aristocratic Frenchmen. With the Magon part of his name referring to one of France's most powerful families. A lot of good it does you. Well, he did what he felt had to do, I guess, as an aristocrat, which is kill himself. I wouldn't do it that way. If I lost everything, what should I do? Kill myself? I was down. I've been down. I've been up. I've been up and down. I've been a predator. I've been a pawn. You remember that song by Sinatra? You got that one? I've been a puppet, a poet, a prophet, a poet, a pawn, and a king. I know it's a pawn and a king. But you have to have been a pawn to understand what it is to be a prince. I've been everything. I mean, I've had to do a lot of things to survive. That's why I can identify.
A puppet, a pauper, a pirate, a poet, a pawn and a king.
In my case, it's a prawn and a king. I've been a prawn, not a king. What would you do if you lost everything? How would you start over? What if you woke up and you're ripped off by this SOB made off of someone like him and you had nothing? Let's say the day before you, and then next day you don't know what to do with yourself. You know, there was a guy here in Marin County, I won't mention his name. I'm talking a long time ago. He was a mortgage broker, and he swindled whatever. He got caught, lost everything. He went to San Quentin. I had him on the show when I was a local talk show host. I won't mention his name. The guy is a real prince in that. Here's a white guy, loses everything, goes to San Quentin, and he survives. And he called my show. And if he's listening, he's entitled to let you call again, please. I said to him, "How did you survive San Quentin?" Middle-aged white guy who was once a rich man. He said, "Well, Michael," he says, "what you do is you barter what tools you have." I said, "Well, what tools did you have?" He said, "I had knowledge. I was literate. And I became the guy who could go to the law books for the baddest guys in the prison. They protected me." I said, "Amazing." And he did. He was unscathed, so far as I know. He came out, did his time, came out and opened a little store. Guess what? To me, he's a gentleman. He's a prince. To have lost everything, go to San Quentin, come out and have the guts to open a little store and thrive in a little store and come back into the community, to me, the man is a star. That's what you have to do. What could you do? What could you do if you lose everything? I mean, I don't know. I do what I have to do. That's all. You're going to die. You're not going to kill myself over money. What are the reasons to kill yourself? Answer, none. None. It's the biggest infamata you could commit if you're an Italian. If you're a Jew, you can't do it. If you're a Muslim, you can't do it. Anyone else, you can do it. Go ahead. Go with my blessing. Because the Bible says that it's the gravest sin you can commit. It's committing homicide against yourself, and it's not your property. You are God's property. That's the brilliance of the religion. So it prevents suicide in religious people, as it should. That's why the atheists are into euthanasia and suicide and all of the other horrible things that human beings can do on the earth, because they don't believe in God. They don't believe in themselves. In order to believe in yourself, you have to believe in God. If you can't believe in God, you can't believe in yourself. You're lying to yourself. That's why you became a drug addict and a degenerate and went to work in Hollywood with the other atheists. Don't you get it? Savage. One 800 449 8255. Relatives, please don't call. No, I don't have any relatives who listen to the show, apparently. I never hear about anyone I know who listens to it. They all make believe they don't listen to the show. It's terrible when you're famous in a family and they get mad at you for your success. They would rather that you're a junkie in a rehab than I know a guy who has a brother. He's a talk show host. I don't really know him personally, but he's not a bad guy. He's on another station. He's very liberal. When I used to be on a station, he's a nice guy. He has a brother who's a junkie. And this guy knows exactly what it's all about. If I were, let's say, a junkie in rehab and amounted to nothing in my life, the relatives would love me. Oh, look at that poor Michael and never got anywhere. How terrible. Let me see if I can help him. But if you're successful, they don't want to know you. It's a law of reversal here. All your life you strive to achieve something, and when you do, you write your first book. Oh, yeah, really? No kidding. I like Stephen King. That was what I heard the first book I published 30 years ago. And my book was really a fine book, and it went very far. Earth Medicine, Earth Foods, 1972. I was so proud of myself. And may he rest in peace. I swear to God, I brought it into my father's market. I think my father was dead already. He had died so young. But a relative was still living, who I love to this day. I have nothing against him. I show him the book. I traveled all, like 6,000 miles. Have you seen my new book, Uncle? Yeah, he said, how much do you make a book? He looked at it like a piece of herring. He opened it up. He said, how much do you make a book? You make a dollar a book. I couldn't believe what I'd heard. Everything was dollars and cents. It wasn't that way for me. Well, at least then it wasn't. I mean, things have changed for me now a little bit more, but I'm almost going back to the way I was then. It's not all about the money. There are certain things in life that transmute dollar value, like children. Like having children, like raising children, and seeing the next generation emerge. And I want to talk about children. I got 2 minutes here. Because a young man called earlier, and he asked me to talk about children. Suddenly, I'm the resident expert on children. But you know what? I'm as good as any, because I have children who are adults, and they're both wonderful people and fine people. And the fact of the matter is, I'm as good an expert as any. I have found in my life that most of the PhD experts on children are either gay or crazy. And were never married. Or if they were married, they either tried to kill their wife or were in rehab for a few years and then came out and went into psychotherapy to find out why they killed or attempted to kill. And then they washed it all away and suddenly they're experts on child rearing. I mean, I'll tell you, that's what I found. So I'm as good a source as any on how to raise a child. You want to hear the number one rule? It's really simple. I remember when I had my first child, I had been living in the islands at that time. I flew all the way home 6,000 miles when my father died to the funeral. And I took my little baby with us. I mean, you know, it was like an infant. It was terrible. I had a reason to come home to that. But you can't pick things in life. Things happen. So after whatever, you know, you go to the house and you whatever and drink and we're sitting and talking. I remember asking one of my uncles, who incidentally did not have children himself, but he was not a bad guy. Somehow I loved him and I thought he knew everything. But he never had kids himself. So I said, well, really, I don't know the rules. How do you raise a child? What are you supposed to do? I didn't know how to raise a child. What do you think, you know? I didn't know. I was not a baby. I mean, I was like 28 at the time, but it was still, by today's standards, I mean, it was like an infant. They don't have children today till they're 60 in Los Angeles. The guy is bald. He's got one foot in the earth, and he marries his masseuse or his Viagra provider, and then they have a baby, and the baby is 12 when he drops dead. I don't know how these kids are all going to survive with these fathers 60 years. All right, that's a second story. So I asked my uncle, well, how do you raise your child? I mean, what's the rules here? My uncle said something to me that I remember to this day. He said, you know what? There are no rules except one that you have to remember. Love them. If you love them, everything will work out. And you know something? He was right. I don't mean unconditional love, like if they smear fecal matter on the wall, you say, what a wonderful piece of art. We're not talking about that. We are talking about genuine love, which entails parameters of behavior that are acceptable. Now, when you get to the teenage years, all rules are off. You can't love them. It's like The Shining appears. At 11, it's your child and you love them. Then one day they come home and it's like Stephen King is The Shining.
Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage. You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
I woke up last night at about 4 a.m. I couldn't sleep. I heard a rumbling in the sky, and I know what that low rumbling in the sky means. I know that the gigantic bombers are on the move. They're coming out of the Air Force Base near Sacramento. I didn't have to read about it in the paper today. I just know they're moving them. I don't know where they're moving them. I don't know how many were being moved, but I heard the low rumble in the sky at 4 a.m., and I said, thank God something's going on behind the scenes because this is getting out of control. You've got a psychopath threatening New York and Washington, D.C. It's astonishing to me what a group of hollow men we have running this country. And then I couldn't sleep. I couldn't get back to sleep after I heard that low rumble because things are very terrifying right now if you really listen carefully. You don't have to put your ear to the ground to know what's going on in this world. All you got to do is take your blinders off and stop watching baseball and get your eyes off YouTube and get your eyes off pornography and get your eyes off, you know, the latest lingerie on YouTube. Stop listening to Moloch's madnesses and start looking at what's going on in your world. And I sat down and I wrote this. Take it for what it is. I wrote this down. I said, I met with my kitchen cabinet last night while cooking a light dinner. As I drank the Bordeaux, I consulted with my chief advisor, Teddy, a 10-pound gray poodle. In my kitchen cabinet with us were Plato, Moses, Jesus, John Locke, George Washington, Lincoln, Patton, and God. Here's what my kitchen cabinet recommended for rescuing America. I wrote out a 4-page plan. You think I'm just a funny guy, huh? Let's start with my plan for rescuing America. Page 1, domestic, A. Cut federal income taxes by 2% per year over 4 years for a minimum total of 8% over 4 years. B, reduce federal government departments in size by 4% each year for a total reduction of size by 16% over 4 years. C, eliminate all public assistance for able-bodied recipients. Cut off all public assistance for immigrants for 5 years. Repatriate those who are not working after 2 years. D, immediately impose tariffs on cars and trucks owned by foreign entities, even if they're manufactured in America. E, cause illegal aliens to build a wall between the United States and Mexico, and then repatriate them. Pay them a one-time worker fee. F, increase pay for active duty combat troops by 10%. Number 2, fire any unmarried military person becoming pregnant while on active duty. Shall I continue? I will, whether you want me to or not. Here's the rest of my domestic policy for saving or rescuing America. G, make abortions illegal except when the physical survival of the mother is threatened, to be determined by 3 medical doctors. Number 2 in that category, require a NORPLAN for all women on welfare of childbearing age. H, close all houses of sex and massage. I, expand the DEA while decriminalizing most drugs. J, regarding the media. One, eliminate all foreign ownership of any American media entity. Two, break up overly large conglomerates like News Corporation. K, encourage childbearing among tax-paying citizens. Create a marriage incentive through lower taxes for married heterosexual couples and a government subsidy for each child conceived and carried to birth. Increase the subsidies for each year the couple remains married. L, repatriate all illegal immigrants now incarcerated. Encourage all other illegals to self-repatriate through double taxation on wages and fines on employers. This is Michael Savage. I'll go on with my international program for Rescuing America. I'm sure that most of you would turn the program off. You'd rather listen to the hollow men in the media. Go ahead and listen. I don't care anymore. We've got a hollow, empty suit running the country, and the only people who can save this country have been silenced by the media bosses. So I'll go on with my international plan for rescuing this great nation. International, A, Iraq. It'll be Iraq, Iran, North Korea, Israel, China, the United Nations. Here it comes. One, sanctions, embargoes, and mine their harbors. Nothing goes in, nothing comes out. C, North Korea. Destroy their launching platforms. Impose a naval blockade on all goods coming in or out except food. D, Israel, Arab entities. Give Israel 4 years to become self-sufficient. Cut off all foreign aid to all nations. E, China, 20% tariffs on all China-made goods immediately, rising by 5% each year for each year China refuses to revalue the currency. F, United Nations. Withdraw immediately. Remove all diplomats and staff. Convert the United Nations building into housing for the working poor. G, Mexico. Force Mexico to pay one barrel of oil for every illegal alien in the United States of America per month. I'm Michael Savage. I approve of this message. I went out on my boat with a group of friends, three couples and two dogs, to watch the arrival on our bay, San Francisco Bay, of the warships. It's called the Parade of Ships. Your captain, Michael Savage, timed it just perfectly. I allowed exactly 31 minutes from departure time from my dock to the bridge, and just as we hit the bridge, we heard on the channel where they were a mile out, and there they were, and there they came, and there they came in such noble glory, led of course by the aircraft carrier. It was so astonishing to be on a small craft and watch seven ships from our fleet come in under the Golden Gate Bridge with all of the young kids, the naval guys and the girls up on the deck in their colors, standing there at attention. It was so beautiful. But here comes the best part. The best part is yet to come. I had been on an aircraft carrier, as you know, last spring, courtesy of the U.S. Navy, the Stennis, and I watched the F-A-18 Hornets take off and land, and I was just knocked out by the genius of our young men who fly those ships, the young men that our vermin in the media will never show you, the young men that our vermin in the media hide. Instead, they show you the junkies and the perverts on a daily basis. The junkies, the perverts, the quislings, the sex change artists, the sex maniacs, glorified by the vermin who run the media, but never do you see the young men who fly those F-A-18s. Well, anyway, we're on the boat, bobbing around out there, holding our place, being shepherded back off to a safe distance by the Coast Guard, doing a great job. They were like the German shepherds of the water. I mean, they were zipping back and forth, making sure we kept our distance, as they should. But we were still close enough, maybe 1,000 yards. I don't know how close we were. But there was something odd about the aircraft carrier as she was steaming in. That was that the jets, a couple of the jets, had their engines on. And I said, what the heck are the jets lit for? Why are these jets lit as she's entering San Francisco Bay? Well, we learned soon enough why. Because out of the blue, kaboom, one of the jets launched off the deck right in the middle of San Francisco Bay. I started to jump like a kid who had seen a train crushing a penny on a railroad track, but one wasn't enough. Here came number two. Boom, went the next jet right in the middle of San Francisco Bay. I had never seen F-A-18 Hornets launched from a carrier deck in the middle of a municipal harbor until that day, and I got to tell you something, I was very impressed. But having said that, I wish we'd use some of these planes. Having said that, I wish we'd use one of these aircraft carriers. Having said that, I wish we'd use the genius and the daring of our sailors and launch these ships, get them out into the South China Sea, launch some of the planes, launch missiles, do whatever you have to do. Take down the pot-bellied pigs launch towers. You can do it with conventional weapons. You don't need anyone's permission. I don't care about the rotten sneakers and the cheap basketballs. I don't care about the knives and I don't care about the shoes. I don't care about the raincoats and I don't care about the cheap dog food. I don't care about the cheap kidneys and I don't care about the cheap currency. Show yourself to be a leader. Knock out the potbelly pigs launching towers now. Show him that there is a meaning to the word superpower. Show him that the meaning of the flag, don't tread on me, has meaning. Show him that America still has balls. Stop acting like a weakling. The people are screaming for leadership. It's not a take down the pot, is what America is screaming for. And don't make any mistake about it. America is screaming for a military strike against North Korea. I don't mean nuclear. Let's be very clear about this. We are not talking about a nuclear strike. It's unnecessary. We are talking about conventional weaponry taking down his launch sites. Don't say to me you don't know where they are. He launched missiles into the Pacific 3 months ago. The very next day I said we should have taken down the missile launch sites. What happened? Nothing. And I say that unless America starts to show itself to be a world leader again, we're going to lose this leadership position that was built over centuries with the blood of our ancestors. Built over centuries with the blood of our ancestors, inherited by a group of people that I have to tell you I have no respect for. I don't know how to put it to you any other way. Every day I wake up and the news gets worse. Every day I see more statements and no activity and no action. Every day I fear for the future of this country. Every day I see them saying one thing and doing another. Every day I see another government official leaving office and going to work for the enemy. Every day I see the very same government officials on these television shows telling us why it's good to screw America. Every day I pray for the arrival on the scene of a man on white horseback. Every day I pray for a man who loves America more than he loves his party. Every day I pray for God to bless America.
Savage.
Why is it that this last generation has become a generation of sluts and empty men who are incapable of raising a family, who are much like girlfriends with a male appendage attached to their body? Have the girls descended so far down the scale of social evolution that they think God put them on the planet simply to have an orgasm and to get drunk and puke on themselves in a nightclub at 3 o'clock in the morning? Who is responsible for this this disgusting imagery that we are that is paraded before us on a daily basis? The celebrity sluts like Paris Hilton, who we all detest. Anyone who does not detest her is a psychotic. How could you not detest these people? It's impossible not to detest what they stand for. They stand for the vapidity of our times. They stand for the death of the West. They stand for the decadence that most sane people do not want to engage in. If you check out the connections between this and the media, you'll find out that there's a reason that Western women do not want to have children and that Western boys have become much like girls with a male appendage, sort of like a pocketbook with short hair for the girls to drag around and show off for a while until they dismiss them and get another human satisfier toy called a man. The men will not have children. They don't even understand that it is the mark of a man to get married and have children. The women don't want to have children because it might spoil their bods. And after all, isn't it all about their bods and their abs and their butt and their lats? Isn't that what the girls want, are good butts and good abs and good lats? Now, why is it that girls are behaving sort of like homosexuals in their mentality? And why is it that our boys are leading a sort of homosexualized lifestyle in their own way? How is it that the entire West, in essence, is engaging in a dance of death, which in many ways mimics the gay lifestyle? How did that happen? I'll let you put two and two together. But I have to take my hat off to the Pope. The Pope is the intellectual, the religious intellectual leader of the West. There are no Jewish leaders, I am sorry to tell you, speaking out as clearly and as succinctly as the Pope does on so many issues. The Pope said that homosexuals are destroying themselves. And I want to read you what the Pope said. And if you have a problem with what I'm reading to you, why don't you send it to the Vatican, not to me? Pope Benedict XVI said homosexuals end up destroying themselves, so the church has a duty to speak out on moral issues that affect the very spiritual and physical lives of man. Now, most Americans know this, which is why anytime they're allowed to vote against homosexual marriage, which they know to be an abomination and a death service, not a life-giving service, they say no to the death service called homosexual marriage. Now, he didn't write that, I did. But I'll read you what the Pope said. I'm quoting now. Quote, in seeking to emancipate himself from his body, man ends up by destroying himself, close quote. The Pope told cardinals, archbishops, bishops, and members of the Roman Curia last week in a meeting overlooked by most of the world's press. The Pope also lamented low birth rates in Europe, saying couples no longer seem to want children. This fact, said the Pope, has penetrated my soul. He continued. He said men and women today are unsure about the future. This fact, alongside the desire to have all of life to themselves, is perhaps the most profound reason for which the risk of having children appears to many as almost unbearable. If we do not relearn the basic foundations of life, if we do not rediscover the certainty of faith, it will also be ever more difficult for us to give others the gift of life and the challenges of an unknown future. The Pope also referred to the controversy over homosexual marriage. He said, quote, at this point, I cannot fail to mention my concern over de facto couples. When new legislation is created that relativizes marriage, the rejection of the definitive bond gains judicial endorsement. Relativizing the difference between the sexes tacitly confirms those bleak theories which seek to remove all relevance from a human being's masculinity or femininity as if this were a purely biological matter. God bless Pope Benedict XVI for speaking out on the seminal issue of our time, which is the homosexual dance of death and the homosexualization of the West. There is a direct correlation between the homosexualization of the media, the homosexual mafia that controls virtually everything that you read, everything that you see, everything that you hear, everything that you wear, and the behavior of our boys and girls, and the fact that they will not have children, and they simply want to party until 3 a.m. and spend the money on designer items so they look good, and they have good abs and good butts and good lats and good delts. After all, isn't a good ab better than a good son? Isn't a good butt better than a good daughter? I'll let you figure out how we have descended to the level below that of the apes. Lower than the chimpanzee, my friend, all a result of the demons who rule the media and have ruled the media to the point of extinction. Do you have a rock and roll song for me here on the program? I don't know. I can't take it anymore. Can't take it. I can't take it. I just can't take it. I can't do this anymore. I can't. I want to fight back, and I can't. We've been destroyed by George Bush and the fake Republicans. We've been destroyed. You got to hand it to them.
Well, I say, come on over, baby. We got chicken in the corner.
You're listening to an encore segment of The Savage Nation.
San Diego, Vinny, welcome to The Savage Nation.
He's one of the originators of the Mambo Society in New York. A lot of the dances you went to were organized by me at the Palladium.
Really? Amazing. Well, I want to thank you for giving me an awful lot of good nights.
Oh, we had a ball there. Sorry, I'd never met you at that time, but we had seven clubs going all at once. So a lot
Vinny,
of
let me ask you something. Why is there not such a scene in San Francisco where there's such a large Latin community?
They've turned liberal. They're not with their music anymore. They're not with their backgrounds anymore. Mostly.
Well, wait a minute. Isn't there a thriving Latin scene, nightclub scene in L.A.?
Yeah, but it's not so much of the Afro-Cuban. They don't play too much of that anymore. It's more modern.
Well, so where is the Afro-Cuban played, if at all, or is it a dead dog?
It's either in New York or mostly in Miami now.
Oh.
Miami's the big place for the Latin American stuff. The Afro-Cuban, all that kind of music is all...
So let's say I'm going to Miami next week, and I'm probably going to go. Where would I go to hear Afro-Cuban music in Miami?
Oh, Jesus, the names of the clubs, I don't know the names right off the top of my head. There's tons
of them. What are you doing in San Diego? Laying low? You retired?
Yeah, no, I'm 69 now. I'm a mortgage banker.
Oh, I want to hear that story. You didn't get touched by the Madoff, did you?
No, not at all, not at all. A lot of people saw that coming. I saw that coming. The guy.
Let me ask you, Vinny, what do you think is the chance of a maid guy visiting Madoff?
Big time.
Oh.
Oh, my God. You know, I'm Sicilian, and my whole family's from the other side.
Right.
And I got into Latin music years ago, and the fellas are all into that, too, you know. There's a lot
they
of
are?
Money in that. Oh, yeah, there's a lot of money in that. Here's the reason. The white crowd, when they would go out to the nightclubs, they'd wreck the place, throw furniture around, break windows. You know, there was always a fight at the end of the night chasing some broad.
Yeah.
And Latin music, those people would come out, they'd get dressed in suits, they'd drink like anybody else. But to them, it was a night out. They enjoyed it. They
yes.
didn't wreck anything.
Yes, 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 yes. It was a family affair. I remember, you know, Vinny, it's funny you should mention that. It's one of the things I liked about the upscale Latin clubs. I remember once I was on a ship I was working on many years ago. It stopped in Panama, and I had never been to Panama. And I stumbled upon Panamanian music, which was very close to the Cuban. It was still Afro-Cuban, but it was Afro-Panamanian. And they were playing in an outdoor amphitheater with the sea splashing up against the seawall, breaking over the – and it was old people and infants and young people dancing the night away. And it was very, very well. The people controlled themselves very well. That was a total difference from the American nightclub scene like you just mentioned.
Totally different. You're right. Totally different. As a matter of fact, there used to be a place in New York called the Taft Hotel. And on a Friday night, it was the American crowd that would go there. And they would wreck the place. And come Saturday night, was the Latin crowd that would go there. I'm sorry, the Latin crowd. And nothing would get broken, not even a glass.
And they were mainly Puerto Rican, correct?
Yes, mostly Puerto
yes.
Rican, and they were just wonderful people. I had a ball with them, and that's
isn't that amazing? See, this is an unknown side story to the music I've been playing tonight that I'm glad you elucidated, because I didn't know truly the differential in terms of how the crowds behave. But here I have Vinny, a man of Sicilian descent, who happened to you ran all those clubs? You ran the Palladium, or which other ones, Vinny?
Riviera Terrace, the El Seclusion on 77 and Broadway, the Colgate Gardens in the Bronx. These were 3,000 seaters. The Colgate Gardens.
Well, what about out in Queens? Were there any such clubs out in Queens?
No, the clubs in Queens that had the Latin music had a bad crowd. Guys you wouldn't want to hang out with.
Yeah, mainly from Jackson Heights.
You got it.
The necktie crowd. Hey, Vinny, how come we can communicate so well? We don't even know each other.
Ah, we come from the same place, guy. It's in our genes, you and me.
Isn't that something? So in I want to ask a few more questions, Vinny. I'm enjoying this a lot, and I'm having a lot of fun. I often wonder how a guy like you, who lived through that whole scene in New York, you're in a sedate mortgage business in San Diego, you know, it's still in your blood. You're still in your blood. You're not bored to death.
No, not at all. As a matter of fact, New Year's, I'm going out to a Latin New Year's party here. They got a big dance in San Diego, and they're bringing in Afro-Cuban bands to play. And I've never given it up. I've loved it all my life.
Are you married?
Yes, I am. No children, though.
But I'm saying you. I only ask that not because I'm looking to date you. I'm saying you're going with your wife.
Yes, I am with the wife.
You got a good sense of humor. Anyway. You got a good sense of humor, but let's say, like, even the Italian food in San Diego, you can't tell me that you find food that you like, can you?
No, not here.
No. Now, that's a truism. Am I right about that? It's almost impossible.
Well, you're right. You can't get anything here. Maybe in Vegas you can catch a couple of restaurants, but that's about it.
Okay, now we're going to go down the list. Give me a Vegas restaurant that you like, that you approve of.
Ooh, jeez. Oh,
now,
wow.
Let's let that go. I know two of them that are really very good. One is way out on a highway towards the way past the airport. It's in the middle of nowhere. It looks like a junk bar. But the giveaway is, it says, we root for the Cleveland Indians. I said, okay, let's stop here. I found, I went in there, actually a guy took me in there. He said to me, Sinatra used to come in here for the pizza, and so did Dean Martin. I mean, it looks like a dump, but the food is really basic and really very good. So do you ever come up to San Francisco and try the food up here?
No, I've been up there twice. I didn't have to go up for business. I didn't try any of the food in Frisco. I don't know what's up there.
Okay. Now, there are a couple of good places. And by the way, the best Italian restaurants in the city, I think, are related in many ways to Sicilian cuisine. I happen to love Sicilian food because it's spicier than Northern Italian. I know a lot of people say they like the Northern Italian because it's less spicy. I happen to like the arrabbiata, you know, side of the scale.
Yes. Yes, the other.
Well, I'd love you to have a copy of my autobiography, Psychological Nudity. It's certainly been a pleasure speaking with you this evening.
Thank you. You know, I've been listening to you over 10 years.
And what?
Over 10 years I've been listening to you. I love your show.
And well, because we speak in the same vernacular, even though we're from different groups and walks of life. I mean, there's a certain commonality in the way I present or the way I see the world and what I say and the way you do.
Yeah, and you see it straight. I mean, you tell it like it is. You know, if anybody can't see it, they got to be blind.
Mm-hmm. Well, you must have a lot of dysfunction in San Diego with the politics down there.
God, they're crazy down here.
Well, they are crazy. They are crazy. They're insane. They took a beautiful Navy town and turned it into a psychological madhouse.
They did. I don't know. You know, half of these people ought to be in prison for what they did to the regular people out in the street. They hurt them.
Well, one of the former mayors of San Diego is now a bigwig in the Congress. She's on the Intelligence Committee. I can't imagine how we can defend ourselves with women like that on an Intelligence Committee. Can you imagine?
I don't know where they find these people. She's ruined everything. Listen, you know.
Yeah, you know what? Let's have a good night. Stay on the line. Give my guys your address. Okay, we're going to send you a Psychological Nudity, Vinny. God bless you. Thanks for calling the show.
Savage.
Knoxville, Tennessee. Steve, you're on the Savage Nation.
I listen to your show all the time, and I hear you talk a lot about the media and how it's become so biased and that they only play the stories that benefit them. Yet when I listen to your show, I hear most of your callers are just singing your praises, and they don't really give you anything to debate about.
Yeah, why don't you give me something to debate about?
I'm sorry?
Why don't you give me something to debate about?
Well, I mean, I'm very liberal, so most of your views...
Also, give me something we can debate. Go ahead. You called. You want to debate. Let's debate.
Okay. First thing that I've been listening to that you've been saying is how you feel that the third world cultures shouldn't be brought into America, that we've brought ourselves to higher standards than that. And
so you think third world standards should be introduced to America and we should, what, give up internal plumbing?
No, is that you do, however, seem to think that we should start torturing.
Now you're changing. You want to talk about interrogating people who would cut your throat, or you want to talk about eliminating the flush toilet? Which one do you want to talk about?
No. What I'm saying is those are the cultures and those are the standards that they hold themselves to. So why would we hold ourselves to the standards of...
Well, you see what you're doing? This is classic liberalism, where you use twisted logic and come up with a faulty conclusion. You are in a war, just as I am in a war, with Islamic fascists who would like to kill you and or convert you. Do you accept that or not?
I accept that there are extremists in the Muslim community that would like to,
yeah. All right, they would like that. And they have no rules with regard to how they treat us. Is that correct? And they're also much tougher. They're much tougher and battle-hardened and more fanatic than anyone you could ever imagine. They feel virtual no pain. They're like supermen. Now, how would you get information from them? What techniques would you use?
Well, I'm not saying that I've got the answers to that, but I think that...
Well, you do. You have the answer, which is don't use any astringent techniques. You have an answer. You don't have it. This is such a typical Democrat call. You have no answer, but you know that what the Republicans want to do or the conservatives want to do is wrong. That's classically Pelosi logic.
And this is why you don't take Democratic calls. And
I just took one. I just took a Democrat call, and you didn't come up with a conclusion, a solution, a proposal, nothing. All you said was your idea of torturing the bad guys is wrong. So I asked you, how would you extract information? You said, I don't know.
Okay. The other point.
Now let's deal with the next problem. Let's deal with immigration. You like illegal immigrants in America?
Not illegal, no. But I don't think we should close the borders by any means.
And so, how would you stop the tide, the millions and millions and millions of illegal aliens coming in from Mexico? How would you stop it?
Well, how do you figure that closing the borders is going to help our country?
Well, wait, you're changing the discussion. We both agreed that we are wanting to stop the flood of illegal aliens into America. Didn't we agree on that?
Yes, illegal, but I don't want to close the borders down. Yes, that's where you go to that extreme. You say don't let anyone...
How would you stop the illegals from coming into America? How would you do it?
How would you...
Well, no, you're not answering me. You just said you want to stop the illegal aliens. I'm asking you how you would do it. How would you do it?
Okay, obviously every system is flawed, and there are other ways than just closing down the...
Give me one other way to stop the flood of illegals who have no fear of our laws, because the laws are so weak and so watered down. They also know that they'd rather put that the American judicial system and the American Justice Department and the Democrats and the Republicans would rather put our Border Patrol agents behind bars than illegal aliens or drug dealers. So how would you stop them?
Okay, the problem with this whole conversation is you're going to such an extreme by closing the entire border and not thinking of any other solutions yourself.
What do you mean by closing the entire border? I didn't say close the entire border. I said make the border impassable by illegal aliens. I didn't say build a concrete wall that no one could go across.
You have said many times that you want the borders closed and don't let anyone in.
No, I never said that. Now you're making things up. In fact, if you read my last book, I had a much more intelligent plan than either of these points that you're raising. I suggested oil for illegals. Did you ever hear that idea?
No. But,
you didn't? That you didn't want to hear because you made up your mind that you're the intelligent, progressive liberal and I'm the oaf who can't think, that all conservatives are unthinking oafs. Well, I came up with an idea called oil for illegals. Make Mexico pay one barrel per oil per month for every illegal alien in America, which are estimated to be between 20 and 30 million illegals here, and make them pay 20 to 30 million barrels of oil a month to pay for the social services that these people are not entitled to, that they're gaining. What's wrong with that idea?
If it could work, then I would be all for it.
Well, now ask yourself why, if I wrote that idea in a best-selling book, not one of the lying schmucks on Fox News or anywhere else would have me on to discuss that idea. Can you answer that question?
Oh, I totally agree that the media is absolutely biased.
We know CNN is biased, but do you know that Fox News is also biased? Are you aware of that?
Yes, very much so.
All right. Why would they not take a conservative idea like that of oil for illegals? Because their bosses have said, we don't want to upset the Republican Party. And the Republicans don't want to demand anything from the Mexican government. Therefore, don't have that savage on the show. See, Steve, if you actually listen to me carefully, you'll find out that I am really an independent, as opposed to those who say they're independent, to let you think that they really are independent when they're really not independent. The fact of the matter is, I also have solutions. They're savage solutions that I offer. They're not just screaming and yelling and no ideas. The Democrats, unfortunately, feel that torture is bad, but they don't come up with a way to extract information from the enemy. They feel that illegal aliens are actually good for America. That's why they won't even pass a Voter ID Act. They're saying that anyone who wants to pass a Voter ID Act is bringing back slavery. Now, what person in their right mind would want an illegal alien to vote in America? I wouldn't. I hope that you wouldn't either.
Not at all. And listen,
You know what I'm hearing from you, Steve? I'm actually hearing that you're not as liberal as you think. You're more open-minded than you think, and you're open to ideas. And I want to thank you for listening to the Savage Nation. Savage. So let's go back to the callers. We got Martin, who's been holding kindly from Cincinnati, Ohio. Martin, go ahead, please. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. I tell you, earlier talking about the complete freedom, and just like with the socialism, how it's a bad thing. I believe complete, total liberty is the good thing, because then people can do whatever they want. And if they choose to do something...
Slow down. Come on, Martin. You're pulling my leg, because you know that there's no such thing as absolute freedom.
Well, but if there was...
You mean the freedom, let's say, for you to walk down the street and grab a child off the street and kiss them? Is that what you mean by freedom?
No, that's like could be viewed as like infringing on that child's rights, so that would be against the law.
Okay. Wait. You just said that against the law. Why would we need law if you believe in total freedom? Why would we need any law at all? So wait, you're agreeing that we need some law, correct?
Yes, the Constitution.
Oh, wait, hold on. Why do we need some law?
Well, because we can have order that way. Chaos is like unproductive.
All right. So we agree, therefore, that total freedom would lead to anarchy. So you and I both agree that we don't need anarchy. We don't want anarchy. It would be harmful to the freedom that we both want to enjoy, the freedoms we wish to enjoy, correct?
Yes.
Okay, so an orderly society needs some laws. We agree on that, but not too many laws, not laws that infringe on our fundamental freedoms and liberty. We agree on that.
Maybe. I believe in, like, the total freedom to do whatever we want as long as it doesn't interfere or infringe on anyone else's rights to do what they want, which is... Mm-hmm.
Well, that sounds good in theory. That sounds good in theory. But there are limitations to that, I mean, that we can start arguing over. You do understand that... Let's start with the obvious, a highway, a roadway, four corners. We both agree you need red lights, yellow lights, and green lights, or else cars would crash into each other, right?
That's correct, yes.
All right, wait, so that's a good analogy for why we need some laws. Because otherwise we'd be crashing into each other or shooting each other or molesting each other or whatever, punching each other in the nose over the slightest disagreement, correct?
That's different than traffic law. That goes back to our freedom of liberty. The traffic law is essentially just structure, just like building codes, like things have to be buried 3 feet because of the frost line. But as far as our choices for moral behavior, I believe that's the government's complete hands-off, because my view is that...
You mean complete hands-off. So, again, we're arguing you should be able to go up and kiss a child in the street?
Well, I mean, at one time people did that in some cultures. I mean, as long as my intent wasn't malicious, then it's not...
Well, what culture could they go up and take somebody else's child and kiss them on the lips?
Well, I don't know. Maybe, well, the Pope gives people kisses.
You're pulling my leg. You know that if you did that, someone would probably shoot you if you grabbed their child and kissed them on the lips and they didn't want you to. I mean, come on, you'd probably be tarred and feathered in this country today. I agree with you that people are very paranoid about their children to an extent I've never seen anything. I'm afraid to even look at a child kindly in this society. Things have become so bad. But I don't believe in total freedom. And look, are you an educated person? You know that there are no absolutes. There's no such thing as absolute freedom, Martin.
I believe there is. I mean, okay, let's look at... I know you've talked
about... Wait. The first principle of science, or one of the primary principles of science, is that there are no absolutes. So how can you argue, then, that there is a thing called absolute freedom?
Because it's our Constitution. We should be allowed...
No, it is not. The Constitution does not promise you absolute freedom. It actually promises you relative freedom. It says you shall have life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That's fundamentally what it promises. Nothing more, nothing less. But it doesn't mean you shall be able to grab your neighbor's son and kiss him on the lips, Martin. I'm sorry. Don't try it in my neighborhood. I know some ex-warriors with young children who would not like it. I'll be right back.